The odds of becoming a signed artist and having 3 number one albums? 1 in 100 million. The odds of going on to win 6 Grammy Awards? 1 in 1.4 million. The odds of this performer having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 110. I'm Toni Braxton, and I encourage you to learn the signs of autism at AutismSpeaks.org. Autism Speaks. It's time to listen. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
Hi, I'm Sima Shapiro, the host of the new contemporary lifestyle radio show for women over 40, featuring everything about your health, wealth, children, happiness, and anything else of interest to you, the listener. Please stay tuned. You're listening to WESU Middletown. Today I'll be talking with Irene Seltzer about eating disorders, what creates them, how to diagnose them, how to treat them, and many more aspects of this. So welcome.
Thank you so very much, and thank you for having me with you,
you know,
in
it's,
your program.
It's my pleasure, because this is not an area that I know a lot about, and I'm sure that a lot of the listeners would really enjoy learning more themselves. I think this is one of the fundamental fears of a lot of women who fear that they themselves may develop or have eating disorders and that their children may also have them. So let me introduce you. Irene is a mental health professional and parenting expert. She regularly lends her expertise on CNN. She has extensive expertise in eating disorders, body image perceptions, and women's issues, working with adult patients with binge eating disorders and with parents whose children are affected by eating problems or disorders and body image issues. In addition to her authorships and philanthropic work, she maintains a private practice in Atlanta, Georgia, where she resides. So let's just delve right in, and let me ask you, what is the definition of an eating disorder?
An eating disorder, or eating disorders in general, Sima, are very, very serious problems. And what I do want to emphasize is that eating disorders are not about food. There are serious emotional and physical problems, and they may be even life-threatening. And there are definitely life-threatening consequences for females and for males. And I think that when we think of an eating disorder, we can think of a range of psychological disorders that are characterized by abnormal eating or by disturbed habits in relation to food. And so the important thing is to know that these disorders are psychological and not just about food, as I said. And that people cannot, it's not something of, oh, just eat or just not eat, because they include extreme emotions and attitudes and behaviors. And so it's not an easy fix, so to speak.
So how do you categorize an eating disorder? Under what category does it come in terms of a disease, a chemical imbalance? How does the medical profession view this?
Well, it's because it's very complicated. We think of it as multi-causal. So it has many causations, and one of them can be definitely neurons and ways in which the brain circuits are wired. Another one is family life. Another one is social aspects of society, the media, how we internalize the media, not just the media, but how people internalize it as well. So there are a great range of situations that go into what makes an eating disorder.
So given the complexity, who would be most likely to treat this? Or when you have an individual who has been, let's say, diagnosed with an eating disorder, do you take a multi-latitude approach with a bunch of different specialists, or do you start with one type and move to another?
Well, that depends a little bit on how this person came to you. Many times you are referred by a medical doctor. Many times you're not. So many times you get someone, and as you're working with that person, you realize that they do have an eating problem and then an eating disorder. So the first thing that I want to tell the audience is that it is very important to work with people that have been trained to work with eating disorders. So if you're going to see let's say either a pediatrician or a general doctor, it needs to be someone that has had training. And so the people who can work with eating disorders are the general doctor that you need to have to follow the patient or the person who has an eating disorder, a psychotherapist, and that can be either a psychologist or a social worker or a counselor, as long as they have been trained and that they know what they are doing. Sometimes you need a nutritionist as well, to help the patient either start eating or get a sense of what a portion is. That doesn't always is that way. Sometimes patients do not want to see a nutritionist right away, or sometimes it is not recommended to see a nutritionist right away, and it's something that you do along the lines when the patient is a little bit more comfortable with facing food. And sometimes you also need a psychiatrist.
I'm absolutely fascinated by this. I don't think I realize the complexity of it. Before we get on to some of the philosophies that are utilized to try to provide healthful tips and healthy ways of really, I would guess that it would have to be recircuiting a person, correct? I mean, it would be healthy ways of looking at eating and looking at their issues, correct?
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
So before we get to that, what I'd really love to find out is everyone's frightened of this. Let's just make that as a basic premise. And so what are the levels that would determine that a person may just be fascinated with food as opposed to have a disorder? Show me a little bit about the differing stages.
Well, it depends a little bit on, let's take for instance, let's think of a teenage girl that starts to diet, for instance. And so you can think of this as different levels of dieting. You can have the first level of dieting, in which mom sees that her kid or his kid wants a parent, you know, it doesn't have to be a mom, and it doesn't have to be a girl, it can be a boy. They start dieting and they just lose, I don't know, 4 pounds, and they are done with the situation. They feel good about themselves and they move on to the whatever they are doing, extracurricular activities, school, etc., etc. The second level is you see that the person becomes a little bit more involved, and they just are, you can see how the diet or the dieting is consuming more of her life, and they may actually not sit at the table anymore. They may be more restrictive. And the first stage, the person, they are on a diet, but okay, they went off the wagon and that's fine. They continue the next day. It's not all consuming. And on the third stage, you just see that the person is really consumed by the diet, has changed friends, or is isolating, and it's really never eating with the family again, because she or he is afraid of food, and they start to be, you start to have battles around food. So there is a progression, and I think the progression goes between being an innocent dieter, so to speak, and just doing it and moving along in life, looking in the mirror and liking what you see, And as this continues, the losing weight is not enough to make you feel good about yourself. And that's the piece where you can see that there is a psychological side to this, which has, that has nothing to do, and it didn't have to do with the body at the beginning of the process or with the way you look. It's just holding on to that to express emotional life. And the same can be the other way around when you have someone that gained a little bit of weight when they go, for instance, to college. And so you can have someone that gained weight and say, oh, okay, I will do this, and they can continue feeling at peace with their lives as opposed to this fact defining who they are.
So what is the earliest age that you have seen children develop eating disorders in the true sense of the word?
Well, it's interesting that you ask that in the sense of what we're talking about, in the sense of body image, because there are eating disorders in infancy that are related to, that are not, they're called rumiation and pica, but that's not what we're talking about here. But those are infant, are eating disorders that can be diagnosed in infancy. And so the interesting thing is that eating is kind of like a barometer of what happens between a baby or a little child and mom. But in the sense that of what we're talking about, I think that little girls around 5 years old and kindergarten, I've seen them, horrified, but I've seen them say, I am on a diet, or I am not going to eat cake at this birthday party because it makes me sad. And by kindergarten, you know that the worst insult is poopy head and fat. Those are the two biggest insults that you can, you know, say from one kindergartner to the other, poopy head and fat. So
this
tells you a lot of where we are as a society.
This is just fascinating. So what are the different types of childhood eating disorders as opposed to, say, teenagers and now as opposed to young adults or, you know, middle-aged women? What are some of the differentiations?
Mm-hmm. As little kids, as eating disorders, if we look at eating disorders from a developmental point of view, there is what's called rumination, and this is a disorder that starts at 3 months or after 3 months, and it starts like after a period of normal digestion. And it is rare in children and teenagers, so it is more in babies, and the cause is not known. And certain problems we think could be lack of stimulation of the infant or neglect or high-stress family situations, but we don't really, really know. And what happens is that the kid ingests the food, and then the food comes back, and they ruminate on the food, and they regurgitate the food, and there is rechewing of the food, and it needs to last like at least a month or so in order to be diagnosed, and it doesn't seem to upset the person that's doing it or the baby. And then there is also another one called PICA, P-I-C-A, and it's the persistent ingestion of non-nutritive substances. And so you see the kids that, you know, just eat little pieces of the wall. They scratch the wall and they eat it. And this, of course, may be just benign or it may be life-threatening. It depends on what they are eating. And so then we go on in the lifespan and we can get what we all know about anorexia nervosa, or many people know about it, and then bulimia nervosa. And lately, we know a lot more about binge eating disorder. And people of starting with teenagers can get anorexia nervosa a little bit later in life. They can get bulimia. It is said that the onset of bulimia is a little bit later than the onset of anorexia nervosa. And binge eating disorder, which is when people eat enormous amounts of food, but they do not have a mechanism to get rid of the food, like in bulimia. And so when people, many people can get to be obese because they don't eat, they don't exercise the food or the calories away, and they don't have any other methods of getting rid of the calories. And so we do know today that the in the United States there is more, and I can't remember the numbers, but there is more binge eating disorder than bulimia nervosa or that anorexia nervosa.
For those new listeners, we are talking with Irene Seltzer about eating disorders. She can be found at IRECELCER.com. Her most recently released book is called 99 Tips to Reset the Table, Parenting in a Society Obsessed with Food, Weight, Obesity, and Body Image. So I'm wondering, what are some of the factors which would make someone become more... What would some of the factors be that would make someone become bulimic as opposed to having anorexia? And is there any research on this?
There is some research. Yes, there is some research, and there is two lines. We seem to think two things at the same time. One is that people who suffer from anorexia nervosa are more restrictive. Anorexia nervosa are more. What word can I use? They are born with more traits related to being very organized and very in control. It's almost a temperamental thing, something that you're born with, a need for organization, and you're very organized and controlled. And people who suffer from bulimia nervosa are more impulsive. That being said, which would be one set of studies, we do know that people can go from flip-flop from one to the other. Another thing that we do know about bulimia is that and anorexia nervosa too, that the majority of the eating disorders come after a stressor, which is dieting, especially bulimia nervosa. When you're on a strict diet, that becomes a stressor for after that, letting loose, so to speak, and becoming bulimic.
So I would have to think, by the nature of this conversation, that so much of this has to do with control, that no matter what direction an older person would go in, and by older I mean a teenager and older, it would seem to me that part of the allure would be something to do with control, either being able to control eating less or being able to control eating more or being able to release the more. Would there be some aspect of that?
I think that control has a lot to do with emotions. So it is a way to deal with your emotions or not to deal with your emotions. and try what you're trying to control through the food is the emotion. So I think that you're both right and not right, because yes, there is an issue. It's like an onion with different layers. So what seems to be the first layer is that you're trying to control, of course, control the food, whether you eat too much, whether you eat too little, whether you're eating at this time or at that time, or how much you're eating, or why are you eating, or you can eat this, but you cannot eat this. It's all about control or losing control. But the having control or losing control, it's also related to emotions.
Just fascinating. So I would guess that the answer to this next question would be it depends upon what practitioner you've gone to. But what are some of the treatments, the therapies, the proven remedies, or are there any remedies?
So we do know that cognitive behavioral therapy or a therapist that knows about cognitive behavioral therapy, that is a very good way to go with eating disorders, because there is a piece of cognitive, a piece of the way people think that you need to fix, together with how people feel. But there is a piece of how people think about food and eating, about what would happen with the food if they eat it, that they need to really understand and dismystify and no longer be afraid of. And
so how would that look? So if I'm a practitioner and my patient has come to me and we're addressing the issue, would I leave him or her with tools? Would I give her exercise or him exercises?
Yes, you would. Absolutely.
And how would that how would that look? What can you give me some examples?
Yes, it would look something like well, let me just think. It would look like I would want to know, and it depends where you are, right? But I would want to know when, so the person describes a binge, right, for instance, or a mini binge, or a situation in which so it depends if you're bulimic or you're anorectic or you're suffering from binge eating. So the person would have, let's say, a binge eating disorder, and you see them once a week, and so they come and they say, "Oh, terrible, I had a terrible week, everything went, you know, by the sideway. I binged on Wednesday evening or Sunday." Sunday actually is the day, right? Sunday or Saturday afternoon. So you work with them or then on their cognitions. Is it true that the whole week was a disaster? No, it's not, because it didn't happen every day. It happened just that one time. Can they pick themselves up and start over? So you work with the fact that they may be generalizing, they may be seeing things in black and white instead of in the grays. You know, they may be catastrophizing. So there are ways in which you can then ask them, okay, next time that you're hungry, maybe can we think of 0 to 10. 0 is not hungry at all. 10 is like you're starving. When do you feel better eating? When you're at a 3, at a 4, at a 5, at a 6. So there are many, many exercises that you can do with people, trying to help them learn about themselves and who they are and how and where do they feel hungry in their stomach. And because a lot of people do not even know that they are hungry or that hunger feels in one's stomach. You know, people may have, the cake may be calling from the refrigerator, so you may have hunger in your brain, but that's not the same hunger than you have when you have stomach hunger. So you may need to teach them that. Or you may need to teach them, you know, when you're watching TV, there's something that happens when you see, you know, a potato chips ad, and are you hungry? Are you really hungry? And can you make a decision instead of just, you try to create a wedge in which there is time between the impulse and the actual going to eat food.
So it sounds like a good part of this treatment would be self-awareness, to really
Absolutely.
Try to understand yourself better rather than just, as you said before, react impulsively, correct?
Mm-hmm. Correct. Mm-hmm. And isn't that all psychotherapy too?
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. Any other methods of treatment or any other therapies that you would employ?
I was trained psychodynamically because I'm from Argentina, and at the time that I trained in Argentina, it was very psychodynamic, which means thinking in terms of like psychoanalytically, and then I moved to this country and I learned a lot about modern psychoanalysis, so I try to think in a way that's psychodynamic and try to understand the unconscious reasons why a person may be going for the food or away from the food, and then give them tools that they can use in the here and now. So I do both. I try to think of unconscious motives, but at the same time, so we deal with those, and at the same time, I give them tools to use from one week to the other.
And I'm assuming that you don't have a boilerplate kind of a template. So at what point do you decide, gee, I really think this person needs blood work. I really think this person must go to a dietitian immediately. I really think that this is not something that I can deal with on a psychological level because I have a mm-hmm. gut feeling, or there's mm-hmm. more evidence that it's in a different mm-hmm. direction. Is that something mm-hmm. you would uncover right in the onset, or do you feel that you would need to do several sessions before you had a better feeling for this person's issues?
Well, if someone comes in and can barely be awake because they are so thin, or they can barely be sitting down because their bones are like not allowing them to, you know, I mean, I can tolerate low weights, but I cannot put someone in danger. So if someone is so thin that they cannot comfortably sit there and think, which you notice, then you cannot do psychotherapy. They need to be somewhere much more structured. Or if you're working with someone and then you say, okay, I will work with you, but if you go under, I'm making this up, right? I'm totally making the numbers up. But if you go under 90 pounds, because then at lower than that, and you don't work on that alone, you work with a doctor,
sure.
then we would have to, you'd have to be hospitalized. Then you need to be ready to hospitalize her if she goes under 90 pounds. The same goes for, you know, if someone is suffering from bulimia and all of her levels, blood levels are such that she may have a heart attack, then she needs to, you know, you cannot see her on an outpatient basis. But in general, well, it depends. You don't know who's going to come in if you get someone new, right? But if you know that it's someone that it's going to have to be in and out of the hospital, you make a decision if that's someone that you can work with.
Sure. So before we go further, I can imagine being in your shoes, and your work must be incredibly painful to witness, and by the same token, it must be incredibly rewarding. And I'm wondering what led you to decide to get into this field.
As I said, I grew up in Argentina, and I've been all over the map of eating disorders myself at a time where I did not, I finished my schooling as a psychologist in Argentina, and we've had, at that point, I've had only two classes. That tells you how old I am also. Two classes of eating disorders in the entire career.
That's
so
amazing.
It was not something that was talked about or very much known. And then I moved to the U.S. and I figured out, oh my God, I'm not totally nuts. This has a name. And so I started to learn about it and to get treatment, and I got interested. I got to the other side. I got, thank God, well, cured, and I began to work with eating problems and disorders.
I was thinking as you were talking that I personally do not have any experience in this realm. However, for periods of time, my son has had stomach issues and pretty serious ones and elimination issues. And what I can tell you is that the complexity of trying to figure out what is the trigger, what is going on here, becomes overwhelming at points. So I am sure that for those people not only going through it, but for their support system, for their families, their friends, you know, the people they work with, it must be absolutely maddening, not only being witness to this, but trying to go along for the ride and seeing if you can be supportive and provide, you know,
and
guidance.
Coming out on the other side, yes. And for mothers of daughters who, and that part of this, I talk about this in my book. If you have a mother that that grew up with Twiggy, for those who know who she is, and for those who do not know, it's like the Kate Moss of the 60s.
I just outed myself with my age. Okay, I happen to know who Twiggy is. Yes.
So for those mothers who grew up in a certain climate with eating problems and eating disorders, and that they think of beauty as a synonymous with a certain body type or thinness, and if they have a daughter that maybe is not as thin as they want to be, or they look at themselves and they have all these preconceived ideas of how this will affect her child, it can be maddening. So if there is a family history of an eating problem, and then the kid starts showing an eating problem, or doesn't start showing an eating problem, but mom is afraid, then it can be a roller coaster.
There seems to be a much widening acceptance of people's bodies, people's lifestyle, people's sexuality. And I'm wondering if you feel that in this kind of revolving 21st century, there's a relaxation of those types of traditional models.
I think there are two simultaneous trends. One that makes me very happy, which is, I don't know if you've seen the latest People magazine with a supermodel size 22.
I did.
You did?
I did.
I think she's gorgeous, and I think she, and on that way of thinking. I think people can look at HAIS, which is headed by Linda Bacon, and she's fantastic. And HAIS means it is about health at every size movement. So you can it's not necessarily advocating we should be all a size 22 or a size 20 or a size 30, but it's ways in which we can be healthy at every size. So to answer your question, I am very happy that younger kids can see different ways, different body images as beauty. And I think that's beginning to happen now. At the same time, I think that there is among teenagers, as there's always been, a need for being uniform and having a certain way of looking or way of dressing that can be very just trying to put people in a box. So mm-hmm. both things are happening at the same time, and I'm glad that kids are seeing more body images, even if they still think, oh, this is cool and this is uncool. And I think that because there are more body images to look at, they can feel those who do not fit in this group can fit in that group, and that makes me very happy.
That makes me happy too.
Yeah.
So what are some of the either the ages or the points which appear to be the greatest trigger points for this to be created? What stages of life?
I think teenagers is a big one because of many reasons. One is it's a mixture of trying to go into the world and trying to figure out who they are going into the world, and hormones and looking a certain way. And believe it or not, lately we are seeing that middle-aged women are displaying, we're seeing a lot of middle-aged women between 40s and 50s that do have, or even 60s that do have an eating disorder. And we do not exactly know yet whether this is that they had an eating disorder that was not treated when they were younger, and it's like coming up again, kind of like shingles if you had the chicken pox, or if it is a new development. And nowadays, I think that we are extending life. Being in your 50s or being in your 60s may bring up a lot of insecurities, and that may be one other reason why we're seeing eating disorders in women. We're also seeing more eating disorders in men than we've ever seen.
And do you have any idea what you would attribute that to?
Yes, I have an idea. I don't know if my idea is totally right, but I have an idea. I think that now society has gotten to be so much more androgynous than it was, and men are having more pressure around the ways they look. And I think that's having a lot to do with it. They have become much more body conscious than they were. You know, a little bit of muscle, that was it, and you looked good. Now it's the six pack in their stomachs, and it has to be a certain way. And I think that's a lot of stress for teens.
It's amazing because here we are in this 21st century trying to strive for acceptance on all levels, and yet we still haven't gotten there, do you know?
Yes.
And I would also think that if you're talking about women, especially in midlife, there must be some hormonal aspect to this because,
yes.
You know, when you first go into puberty, a lot of times you're just completely lost. And I think
yes.
It's true for women in perimenopause and menopause. I mean, not only are they hormonally off, but they look in the mirror and they probably don't recognize sometimes when they look in the mirror at themselves, they don't recognize themselves. I would guess that would have some bearing on this.
Absolutely. I think that it, and you know, and menopause and perimenopause, I mean, jokingly and not jokingly, you know, we are, and you know, mental health people always say that there is nothing more, when you have a new family that you're going to see, you want to know if the daughter is an, it's in puberty and the mom is menopausal at the same time, because you know there'll be sparks there, and you know people will be like, "Ah," because hormones are very potent and changing. No one likes to see their body change, and because we have such a big emphasis on beauty ideals and youth, someone who's becoming less youthful has to have a reaction, and a hormonal reaction, especially if that person lived her life very focused on her looks.
Yes, absolutely. In terms of trigger points, other than life cycles, what about the impact of getting married, getting divorced, losing a spouse, losing parents? Mm-hmm. Can incidents like that trigger full-blown eating disorders, in the clinical sense of the word?
They can be a stressor, and I think they can, not one day to the other. You don't develop, but yes, you get a divorce in your 40s, and then you're trying to look better, and but you haven't really gotten the whole thing about being independent, or you didn't get the whole thing about, you know, you really didn't deal with the divorce, so to speak, well, or you didn't, or you're getting married and you're not, you're having an issue moving on to the next level of your life. So yes, absolutely, it can be a stressor that it's necessary to deal with, especially if the person has had some brushes with it. If the person had a brush with an eating disorder when they were a teenager, you want to, you know, be mindful of that, and be mindful that the food does not become the focus of their lives.
I see. I'm wondering, because you have a couple of decades of experience, I'm wondering what other factors somehow have a factor in someone's eating disorder. Do you see any other concrete statements you can make about political factors, the economy, our current economy?
I think that it's easier to have, I don't know about an eating disorder per se, but I do know that binge eating disorder and obesity, I do know that obesity is more rampant on low social economical classes, and that in trying to fix the obesity, you may end up with an eating problem.
So, you know, there's been so much talk in this country about, you know, the gaining girth, and how so many people are now overweight, and how Americans must, you know, modify their eating habits. Do you see correlation to that with the economy, with the state of affairs?
I do know that if you go... I do know that if you go in New York City, at least, to a play, to a supermarket, that it's in a very impoverished area, or if you go into a supermarket in West Virginia, in an impoverished area of West Virginia, I do know for a fact that what is sold there, I wouldn't even consider it food. And so we do know from even, I do know that personally, and I also do know that a lot of people who are working right now on the topic of obesity are also talking about quality of food, and that quality of food and economics is definitely related.
And so options for example, what you're saying, options for lower socioeconomic classes would be options that are synthetically made
food,
right, which we all know. But
but we all know and don't know, because we all know. It's those things that we do know, and then we don't want to either look at them. I have so many patients that don't even know what a portion looks like.
Wow.
That they cannot gauge from the inside. They don't. A portion is whatever it's served from the outside.
That's amazing. I mean,
yeah,
it's
amazing.
Because
it's
that's amazing. A fundamental thing that, you know, as a parent, you would want your child to have some sense of what a portion would be, correct? I mean, that would be something you would learn at home.
Yes. Yeah.
Is it possible to ever be cured of this?
There are different philosophies. From me, I'll give you a yes. It is possible. Other people feel that it's like a regular addiction. So you can be, you know, you always have it. That's what other people, you know, they're two different philosophies. One would be that yes, that you can get cured, and the other one is that no, you do not get cured. You just manage it forever. I mean, like AA, like you're forever an alcoholic, but you're just not drinking, and you have to work on yourself. So I believe that you do get cured of an eating disorder. Now, that being said, and I'm 100% there that you can be cured, I also have to say that I think people, when they are stressed, they will tend to go back to the place that they were at. So if you get cured, but then you had, let's say, when you were a teenager, you were having episodes of anorexia or bulimia, and then you're, you know, 32 and you're about to get married and you are getting stressed about it. It could be that the eating problem doesn't appear, but it could be that people get anxious and that's where they go. So they either feel a little bingy or they feel a little, you know, like restricting. And we're back to what you were saying. It is about self-knowledge and self-awareness.
And so back to the initial question about the genetics versus chemical imbalances versus emotional disturbances, how is a person to kind of self-diagnose themselves in readying themselves for deciding which therapist or therapy they would like to, you know, approach this with? Do you know what I mean?
I don't think we have the percentages of saying, okay, this is this much this and that much that and that much the other one.
Okay.
So I think that people need to get recommendations from, you know, you can go to the different organizations, and then shopping for a therapist is like shopping for a doctor. You need to know where they were trained. You need to know what their knowledge is, and you need to see that you can work together. You need to like the person. The person needs to be someone that you trust, and I'm not taking this lightly. You need to click, because it's going to be a journey together. And so it needs to be someone that you can work with.
And I'm wondering, do you have for your own practice a kind of statistical analysis of what is the expected time period for which you might see someone, or what is the average time that patients stay with you? Or is that too all over the board?
I hear that every first session with every new patient that I've been seeing for the last 20 years. So I'm going to answer you what I say. I don't know, but it's something that you decide with the person, and it's a decision that people take together. It could be 6 months for some people, or it could be 6 sessions for some people that they get the hang of it, and it's not really entrenched. It is just about them learning a little bit, and their life is not, you know, is not just revolving around that. They are just stuck a little bit. Or it can be 2 years or 3 years.
So you mean that the first session sort of looks like, Doc, can you tell me how long before I'm cured? Is that the question? Yes.
Yeah. In general, that's how it goes.
Yes.
And so the good thing of that is that it's not like one day that you're cured, you know. It doesn't – life is not going to be like for – like I'm making this up, of course, right? But if Alice comes to see me, it's the first session is not going to look like 6 months later. So 6 months later, hopefully she'll be doing better than the first session.
Sure.
So it's not going to be the same amount of suffering, we hope. And the person can say, this is how long or how far away I want to, for how long I want to be here. This is the goal, not, you know, and it's their goal, not your goal as a therapist. I mean, you can have a goal too, but it doesn't have to be the same goal. So it could be anything up to 2 years or three.
We're running out of time here, and I'd just like to hear your final words. If you have any thoughts or tips for the listeners, could you kindly share them now?
I want mothers not to look in the mirror and criticize themselves in front of their daughters or sons. I want mothers to say, you know, I look okay for who I am and I look the best I can and I'm happy with it. And if they don't feel it, just fake it. Fake it till you make it, because kids learn from what they see, not from what they hear you say. It doesn't matter if you tell your kid that she or he looks fantastic if you are looking in the mirror criticizing yourself. And you cannot feed your kid vegetables either while you're eating fried whatever three times over every
TV
day.
TV dinners.
So I do believe that food is food and you can eat anything, including the fried whatever. But lead by example is my point.
That's wonderful. We've been talking today with Irena Seltzer about eating disorders. She can be found at IRECELCER.com. Her most recently released book is called 99 Tips to Reset the Table, Parenting in a Society Obsessed with Food, Weight, Obesity, and Body Image. She maintains a private practice in Atlanta, Georgia, where she also resides. This has been a fascinating hour. I learned so much more than I've ever known. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. Bye-bye. Thank you so much.
Like what you hear on WESU 88.1 FM? Consider making a donation. WESU is an independent, non-commercial station that relies on the generosity of listeners like you. You can donate online at WESUFM.org or by mailing a check to our Broad Street address, which you can find on our website. Thank you again to our listeners for keeping us alive and thriving on the airwaves since 1939. We appreciate your support.